How's everybody doing? Hoping you're having a fantastic day. So I decided to do a quick stream this week because Lofton's new book, Michael Lofton from Reason and Theology, his new book has released against orthodoxy. And I was curious to kind of scour those chapters where I have some vested research interests just to see if there's anything that I could critique or even glean from them. And I was very much sorely disappointed. And before I begin on some of the reasons why I was disappointed, this isn't going to be a comprehensive review or anything. This is just kind of me making a few observations about methodology a bit. But what I wanted to read real quick is just a small snippet from Prima Pars from St. Thomas. He's talking about in the context of knowing the Trinity by natural reason. And he, of course, as many of you know, argues against knowing the Trinity by natural reason. But he gives some reasons why it's a bad idea to use these type of arguments against those who do not affirm the Trinity. And the second reason he gives is very important. He says, second, as regards the utility of drawing others to the faith. For when anyone in the endeavor to prove the faith brings forth reasons which are not cogent, he falls under the ridicule of the unbelievers, since they suppose that we stand upon such grounds and that we believe on such grounds. Now, that's kind of the reason why I think that such a video like this is appropriate. Because for me, if there was a video, who should I state to as, let's say Jay Dyer came out with a book against Catholicism. And it was basically the Catholic version of the book that Michael Lofton just published. I would probably be less inclined to do a review of it. I might like tweet once or twice or point out a silly thing in there or whatever, but I'd be less inclined to put in the effort to make a video about it. Why is that? Well, the reason is because when you make bad arguments in favor of Catholicism, or at least you do sloppy work or it's insufficient or whatever you want to say, it's more important that you treat those from your own guys than it is that you go and start fighting somebody else in some other team. People have gotten mad at me in the past for how much more willing I am to attack fellow Catholics when they say bad things, give dumb arguments, basically. Not saying that Lofton's arguments are necessarily dumb. I think they're bad, but I don't think they're dumb. When you just hear like the absolute recesses of like discord Catholicism against Protestantism or Islam or Eastern Orthodoxy or whatever it may be, the reason I'm more willing to attack those than against those that are against Catholicism is because for the simple reason that I am very much concerned with the fact that the Catholic faith not look stupid. That should be a central concern for all of us. Make sure that the Catholic faith does not look stupid. So to be honest, I do think that we very much more dispose Orthodox, Protestants, Muslims, whoever, to considering the Catholic faith as credible when we do make videos like this. I'm sure there's going to be plenty of Orthodox out there who will watch with interest my video, this video right here, and will probably be more disposed to thinking that Catholicism isn't as silly as he thought. He's going to keep his disagreement, but he's going to be obviously more disposed to listening. Okay, so I just kind of had three small observations that I wanted to make about the general methodology of the chapters that I did read. So the chapters that I read, actually, let me pull up the PDF real quick. What are the chapters that I did read? I read part one. So part one, I think I skipped the Jesus Forgives Sins, Not the Priest chapter, and I don't think I skipped any other chapter. But yeah, basically all of part one, and then a few chapters in part two. Not the papacy stuff, because I'm not an expert on the papacy, so I wouldn't be able to read, well, give much of a analysis of that. And then not really any of the third section. I didn't really feel like wasting my time reading about clown masses from Lofton. I'm not really interested in reading about that. Okay, so that's what I did read. That's what I did read. And I had some observations about methodology in general, not necessarily about details, because he didn't really go into much detail. So the first point that I wanted to make was his sort of gotcha methodology. So basically what Lofton does almost throughout all of the doctrinal chapters is he'll begin with some sort of introduction, rhetorical introduction or whatever, to the topic, some cultural reference or some joker, how you begin a chapter. That's just how he begins it. And then after that, he just kind of makes a short comment about what the Catholic teaching is. And then he just quotes a sort of series of Orthodox scholars to kind of make it seem, which in some cases is actually true, make it seem like the Orthodox teaching is somehow ambiguous, or that somehow there are Orthodox scholars who agree with us, or blah, 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 blah. And with this sort of gotcha methodology, it's basically the anti-Orthodox equivalent of James White saying that there are Roman Catholic scholars who say that the perpetual virginity is wrong. Like, if I was an Orthodox, I would read through this interesting litany of quotes and say, yeah, I don't care. So what? Who cares? And it's really really what all there is to it. It's actually kind of crazy for an introductory book how many quotes there are, because some people, their response to me of lack of detail and whatever was like, oh, it's just an introductory book. Well, introductory books usually don't spend 60 to 70% of the book just quoting other people. That's basically what it is. It's just quoting a lot of people. Usually if you're going to quote anything, you just kind of keep it to the footnotes. So yeah, just as like a point of methodology, the sort of gotcha methodology of, oh, Orthodox scholar says this, or oh, Orthodox scholar says that, isn't really helpful. Like, for example, in his Filioque chapter, I thought the Filioque chapter was extremely unconvincing. If I was an Orthodox and I just read that chapter, he's like, yeah, Shishensky, he says that there are Western fathers who teach the Filioque. Therefore, Orthodox are wrong. And it's like, okay, well, that's not really that convincing. I mean, kind of just pulled a single scholar and said, yeah, he says this, therefore you're wrong. Which it doesn't even really deal with the normal response, because I've been dealing a lot with the normal response that the Orthodox are going to give, which is basically a much better argument, actually, if you wanted to kind of retain this, would have been to say, well, when you look at the sort of ordinary Orthodox reply to the Western Fathers, it's something from St. Max. Well, it's based on St. Maximus, and saying that St. Maximus is somehow an authentic interpreter of the Western tradition, and St. Maximus denies the Filioque, therefore, which there's problems in its own right with that interpretation. But they're gonna pull that sort of argument, basically. And we could point to either one, the sort of internal inconsistency argument, which is like, hey, this isn't what you say. This isn't what Photius says, and what you kind of deal with when it comes to St. Augustine and St. Fulgentius, unless you're like crazy, like Truglia or something like that, want to say that Fulgentius believed in eternal manifestation and was like a Palamite or whatever, which if you want to, you could go that direction, but it's just not a good idea. You could point to the internal inconsistency, or you could just, you know, go to the fathers and kind of do what I did and argue, hey, this is just not a good reading of it. But having a series of, yeah, Shishensky says, and then give two quotes that say through the sun. You might as well just not write that chapter if that's all you're going to say during it. Not only is it not convincing, it shouldn't be convincing to anyone. If I met an Orthodox person who said, hey, I was convinced of the Filioque because I read Michael Lofton's chapter on it, I would be very worried. I would be very, very worried. And I would want him to be convinced at a bit of a higher level, whether it's through the sort of study of certain sections of scripture or through certain fathers, but reading like, I don't even know how many words. It wasn't that many pages, probably like 6 or 7 pages. Reading 6 or 7 pages of Shishensky says, and you venerate these guys and then not deal with like the most basic response that you'll get in like Orthodox YouTube shorts on the Filioque. It's just not going to be helpful for anyone. And then he also, the sort of gotcha methodology gets a bit funny in some places as well. For example, in the chapter on the Immaculate Conception, he says, well, Orthodox are going to have to deal with the fact that in their own tradition, there's people who affirm the Immaculate Conception, like Caps, Father Caps or Compass or however, Cobbs, I've never heard his last name actually said. But he says about Scholarius, Patriarch Scholarius, who was a 15th century Patriarch of Constantinople. And it's like, wait. This is not only is this like a tertiary source sort of situation going on here, but also this kind of ignores the fact that I'm sure Lofton believes that most of the medievals denied the Immaculate Conception outside of Scotus. Well, at least most of the golden scholastics, which is usually the narrative that Albertus Magnus, St. Thomas, Bonaventure, and so on, Alexander of Hales, and they all, based on Bernard of Clairvaux, denied the Immaculate Conception. That's the usual narrative. I don't buy it, and I actually think that that reading's wrong. But like, for argument's sake, come on, man. That's like, you're literally treating the Immaculate Conception right now. You have to like realize the irony that literally the first argument that crosses the mind of most Protestants and Orthodox out there are that we are inconsistent with our own tradition on the Immaculate Conception. Or we could take like a situation where there probably is actually some difference on, which is the fact of the orders and whether the episcopate is a higher grade of orders than the priesthood. Like it actually does seem like a lot of medievals did err on this point. The majority of medievals did err on this point, which that's the story for another day. But come on, this is just like a bad methodology. It's a terrible methodology. It's inconsistent. It isn't good. And it's really just going to lead to a lot of Orthodox reading it and probably thinking that we don't have good arguments for our stuff. Okay, so my second, and I think this is actually the more dangerous one, is he does this apologist thing. And I see there's 26 comments in my comments. Unless there's a super chat, I'm not going to answer anything. Sorry, guys. I'm just not going to really pay attention. Nothing against you guys. So there's in his writing a purposeful ambiguity and also like a minimalism when it comes to the interpretation of the teaching authorities of the church, whether that be the magisterium itself, which is kind of odd, or even the theological schools and what becomes certain theology through common opinion. And why this is important, I think it should be a saying. This isn't a saying, but there should be a saying that's something to the effect that only an apologist could take that theological opinion, because basically, the way that a lot of apologists, which is why you guys better not call me an apologist ever. I hate the title. I don't hate the title in itself. I just the way it's used is super cringe. So I don't want to be called an apologist. I'm not an apologist. But the way that apologists often work, and in this case, Lawton, in some sections of this book, seems to take this methodology, is basically take a position that is the least difficult to defend against outsiders. Take the position which is least difficult to defend against outsiders. So it's easy to paint difficult is to paint over difficulties against the teaching of the church when you take the position that requires the least amount of difficulties. People do this with things like predestination and election. I think this is what Molinism is largely driven by, is apologetics against atheists. People do this with, let me think what else, things like limbo. That can be a lot of times more personal difficulties. But yeah, like taking Cayetanus's reading on baptism of desire is, if you're following proper methods of theological authority, you're going to have very, very good reasons for taking that position. It's possible, but you're going to have very, very good reasons for taking it, which usually people are more driven by the fact that the contrary is difficult rather than proceeding properly through theology, which is the method of authority. So really what this leads to is a grave difficulty when people begin to realize, when they get past the apologetic stage, because what's important is the fact that apologetics is the first catechesis. People learn about the faith first, for better or for worse, this is the case. They learn first from apologists. So when they actually start to, they get through catechesis, through formal catechesis, and start to get into deeper theological readings, the grass doesn't seem as green. And a lot of times people feel betrayed because what they were presented with as the most likely option, or as the teaching of the church, or as a valid opinion, ends up just becoming a sort of fringe opinion that sometimes you technically can keep and other times actually can't even keep. So this is a very common problem within Catholic apologetics, is they take theological positions that only an apologist would take and a theologian would honestly, we're working from proper methods of theological authority, but they would never take these positions. I'm trying to think of an example. Oh, yeah, the example with purgatory is really, really weird. I had to actually read this to make sure I was reading it correctly. Let me check where I screenshotted this. Sorry, I need to go grab this to see what he exactly says. I don't want to be uncharitable in my interpretation. Okay, so... Okay. Yeah. So basically, Lawton, on a section on purgatory, he starts to talk about the purgatorial fire. And he says, and this isn't me misinterpreting him, I read it over a few times. This is his clear sense. He's saying that it's possible for one to either affirm or deny a purgatorial fire. And then for those who do hold that there is a purgatorial fire, one can either interpret it as metaphorical or literal. That's the position he takes. Now, the bigger problem isn't with the second half, although we can talk about whether the purgatorial fire is literal or not, or whether the fires of hell are literal or not, or whether the fires of purgatory are identical to the fires of hell. We can talk about those later. That's not the important part right now. That's very, very minor, much more of a minor issue to talk about. But you can't deny that there are purgatorial fires. That's just not true. You can say that putting aside the question of whether they are literal or metaphorical, could say literal, metaphorical. That's a discussion for a different day. I think they're literal personally. And I actually think there's a minor censure to saying otherwise, but again, story for a different day. But it's just obvious that you can't say that the purgatorial fires just aren't even a thing whatsoever. I won't open up Denzinger and look through it. today. But there are plenty of documents, for example, from Lateran IV all the way up to Leo the 13th. I mean, and so on, that mentioned purgatorial fires. So just look at the New Denzinger, look in the back where it talks about purgatorial. It'll quote the places. This is the New Denzinger. Quote the places where the Magisterium actually does talk about purgatorial fires. And then that really weird, out of context, quote from Ott. I thought that was really strange. But that's, again, story for a different day. But you just have to hold that, at least in some sense, there are purgatorial fires. To say that this is just kind of an option is just wrong. Whether you say they're literal or not, again, minor censure, story for a different day. But have to, in some sense, say there are purgatorial fires. And what's the motivation for this? Well, the motivation for this is that it's a lot easier to leave that option open for people, so they can just kind of squeeze into the sort of corridors or like the edge of the theological orthodoxy in the church. And that's just not a good methodology. It's not a good methodology at all. Rather, the common and certain opinions are those that we should be like. People get this so backwards, and I'm sorry if I'm really rambly here or if I'm quite slow here. But I've been thinking about this a lot recently. But when you're talking to neophytes, when you're talking to catechumens, when you're talking to people who are inquiring into the church, you shouldn't be giving them fringe takes, or even if they happen to be acceptable fringe takes that are only accepted by few. Really, when you talk to people that are new to this thing, you should be giving them the common and certain takes. You should be giving them that are held by the majority, or at least have been held by the majority. You shouldn't be sort of introducing them to kind of like the limits, you know. You should be introducing them to the basics and the commonly held beliefs, not kind of like the interpretive limits out there in the wilderness that two theologians 500 years ago held to. That's not what you should be doing. You should be that should be something that is for later research and actually for a more mature theologian to consider. You should really just be kind of keeping it to what is commonly held, what is ordinarily taught within the schools. That's what you should be. That's what you should be talking to people about. Even historically, seminarians, and these are people who are obviously very well catechized and have even engaged in some, albeit unofficial, theological study. Even seminarians weren't really introduced to some of these opinions that are commonly brought up in Catholic apologetic circles. Like, for example, it's very common to hear about Caetanus's view on baptism of desire. It's a very, very niche topic. It's a very niche topic. And it's so niche that when you look into older manuals treating the relevant topic, Caetanus's view might be treated in a scolium, which a scolium is kind of like a little notes which are given afterwards on topics that you kind of don't really need to know about in too much detail, but which are kind of cool to know, you know, that sort of thing. So ordinarily, seminarians weren't even taught about this stuff. It was kind of more the purview of theologians to talk about in monographs and such. So it's really confusing why all of these sort of niche theological topics are brought in like an introductory book, like the So anyways, like you shouldn't be kind of bringing up odd interpretations or different interpretations that are taken by theologians. Just take the common opinion and present it and defend it. Because, again, you're dealing with inquirers, you're dealing with catechumens. It isn't prudential to do otherwise. And then lastly, to be perfectly frank, I think the work is kind of a bit sloppy in some places, and that's easy to detect. For example, when you go through the entire chapter on original sin, the idea of original justice or original righteousness, at least from what I saw, wasn't even mentioned once. It's not that long of a chapter. So if you just look through it, it's not mentioned once. Now, what's the issue with that? Well, original justice is that of which original sin is a privation of. So if you simply just gave a small section of what original justice was and then explained, okay, original sin's a privation of this, it would be a lot easier. But rather, Lofton doesn't even mention that to which original sin's a privation of. It's a really odd privation. It's a really odd privation for such a chapter. No pun intended. Actually, pun intended. And that actually would have really helped with people understanding the Immaculate Conception chapter, because we can look at the difference between the preternatural and supernatural gifts versus natural gifts in original justice and what was lost in the wounds of the various faculties and so on and so forth, which would have been super helpful with explaining the Immaculate Conception and why immortality isn't necessarily a something which is a gift of nature. It's actually a preternatural gift. So yeah, that would have been helpful, but you know, it's just a bit sloppy in places. I don't know how better to describe it. For example, in another place, this gave me a heart attack. He said that the Father and the Son are as one act of the Spirit. What is that supposed to mean? That's not a thing. The Father and the Son are as one principle and spirate as by one act. The Father and the Son aren't one act of the Spirit. They spirate him by one act. Persons aren't acts. It's just like things like that. It's just a sort of there's a discipline that's needed for theologians and apologists as well in order to describe things with consistent and accurate and precise language. So when people hear the same sort of terms and language and descriptions over and over again, they get introduced and inculcated into that terminology, and it disciplines their thinking. When you discipline people's language, you discipline their thinking. So to see slip-ups like that, it's just very unhelpful. Okay, so I do see that there is Big Steve. Don't read this. Thank you, Big Steve. Okay, that was the one super chat. There's a lot of messages. Probably not going to answer any. Okay, well, I hope you all have a wonderful rest of your day. Hope this was helpful. Sorry for my rambling. And as always, God bless.